Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. Our guest in this edition is Travis Mills. He's a U.S. Army veteran of the 82nd Airborne Division. He served three tours in Afghanistan. And in 2012, he was severely wounded by an improvised explosive device in Afghanistan, resulting in the amputation of all four limbs. After numerous surgeries, he began a very difficult road to recovery and also founded the Travis Mills Foundation, which we'll talk about in detail as well. And Travis, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Where were you born and raised?
I am from Vassar, Michigan, born and raised in a small town right outside of Saginaw and Flint area. Basically, like you see on Andy Griffith's show, a little town like Mayberry, and just really great childhood.
Was there a history of military service in your family?
So in my family, my grandpa was in the Navy in the Korean War. My dad was in the Army, not during wartime. He wasn't old enough for Vietnam. And yeah, so there definitely was a history.
Why did you join the service and why did you choose the Army?
So the reason I joined the military was because I was in college playing college football. I wasn't really there for school, I was there for the football program. And I realized that college wasn't my thing at the time. So I moved back home, tried college near home, didn't like that either, and thought, you know what, I'll come back when I can focus. And I started talking to the recruiting branches, and I had it narrowed down to the Army and the Marines. And the Army won out with the Airborne Paratroopers, and I joined in 2006 in March.
What did you love about the paratroopers?
Tom Hanks, you know, Band of Brothers. So that was a big pull. But really, it just seemed like an elite, you know, fun place to be. I went through basic training, and I had the airborne contract. And then they came down to graduation. They said, pick your duty station between the four. And I chose to go to the 82nd, and no regrets.
What was that training like?
Oh, easy. Everybody thinks jumping out of a plane is hard. It's not. It's gravity, you know. So the training for paratroopers is just run a lot and then jump out of airplanes and let your parachute do the work. And then you have a second one if the first one doesn't work. But I had to use it one time. It's fine.
When was your first deployment to Afghanistan and what role did your unit have there at that time?
My first deployment to Afghanistan was in 2007. We left in January and it was a 15-month deployment. I was part of a headquarters battalion. I was an infantry guy, but this lieutenant colonel wanted three infantry guys for his personal security detachment. So he pulled us and everybody's like, oh, you're infantry. I'm like, I have four more weeks of training. But I went there to be his personal security. Best job ever. At 19, I was a private second class and I was assigned for $6 million worth of equipment and became a truck commander. So I was in charge of if we shoot at somebody or if we don't by the age of 20. And you know, it was a good time. It was a really, really good way to come up in the military. And I think it really helped my leadership style because I wasn't the guy that yelled at anybody. I was treated like an adult and the hazing wasn't there and things like that. So I was different with my second and third deployment in my leadership positions because I was just always happy and smiling, had a good time.
Did you have much interaction with the enemy on that first deployment?
First one, we didn't really. We had a couple, like an IED or a VBID go off and things like that. So our first deployment was, you know, it wasn't anything crazy. The best part about that deployment, my brother-in-law, who was just my medic, had a little sister, thought I was cute, and she sent a MySpace friend request. So I hit accept because I love to antagonize people. I'll give you for instance, like when I was injured, my mom was next to my bedside, right? And I said, Mom, why'd this happen? And she's like, well, you know, karma, you know, so there's that. But she didn't really, my mom's a saint. She's fantastic. But no, I mean, we didn't see a lot of action on my first deployment. I'll be the first to admit that. We had a few things here and there, but nothing crazy. And, you know, saw my fair share of picking up some of the pieces after bombs went off or things like that. But I lifted weights 3 hours a day, had hot meals, and I went on patrols and came back mostly every day. So pretty good deployment. Like I said, I met a girl online, happened to end up marrying her, and we've been married 14 years now.
Fantastic. It's a pretty good deployment.
Yeah, it was.
How about the second one?
So my second deployment, we went back overseas and I was with 473, which is a cav unit. I was an infantry guy and we were part of the coin platoons, they called them. So there was two infantry squads and two cavalry squads and we worked together and, you know, in harmony, of course. But we were a little more active. We had about 6 months out of the year-long deployment that were really hectic and crazy, which you know, as a team leader over there and then a squad leader over there, it was a lot of fun, a lot of chaos. And we jumped around from Herat to Bala Mergab. And there's actually a Marine MARSOC unit that wrote a book about Bala Mergab and what was going on up there. And we went in there to help clean it up. And I mean, it was just a wild deployment. On that deployment, I actually re-enlisted. My wife and I really understood the military lifestyle, and we bought a house while I was on my way back home. And when I got back, we found out we were going to have a baby. It was really exciting. Like, you know, my life was going really well. I got promoted to E6, bought a house, had a daughter, and just no complaints.
What was the interaction with the enemy like on the second deployment?
Second deployment, we had my first duty station or first area out in Herat. We went out to Rabat Sangi. We had a ANP, Afghan National Police Commander, that was a former Taliban commander. So he had great intel. Within the first, honestly, like 3 days, we wiped out a lot of the HPTs in the area. We really put a hurting on their operation. And then they kind of left us alone. And they ended up actually sabotaging the ANP commander and executing him and paying his driver off. So I was really sad. But then it was really barely anything, a few things here and there. And then they moved us up to Bala Mergab because the fighting was so intense and they needed us to backfill some units that were getting some injuries and some casualties. So we went up there and it was a line in the sand. You knew if you crossed that line, it was go time. But, you know, like I said, real fun deployment. The enemy never had any idea. We only had 21 guys on the front line of it. And we had 7 guys that we'd rotate out to the top of this, I don't want to say mountain, but top of this hill. And we dug in 8 feet. We had a whole living room kind of set up with beds and everything, like 8 feet down the ground with 2 or 3 firing pits. We shot like 29 javelins. Yeah, it was pretty intense deployment. But then, you know, we got there. And I'm not saying any units are bad, but 82nd's obviously the best. So when we come to town, you know, we decide that we're not playing no more games, and we go after it, and we get after it, and we took more ground, and when we take ground, we have Italian forces backfill us, and we take more ground, and just keep pushing the security bubble out.
What made you so effective?
I think just the standards that we held ourselves to, the ability to go out there and, you know, throw 300 pounds on your back in the middle of the night in a rainstorm and slosh through muddy fields, and all of a sudden, you know, the Taliban wakes up and we're in one of their compounds and they're getting driven back and just never say quit.
What was the assignment on the third deployment?
So third deployment, we went over and this deployment was going to be a 9-month deployment. I had orders taking me to Fort Hood, Texas, actually, after my year of stabilization was up. And the big army said, you know what, Sergeant Mills, you don't have to go. Like, you got over 2 years of combat experience. We need to build this new brigade up and we need, you know, combat tested and proven non-commissioned officers. And I thought that's not fair to my guys that serve underneath me. I worked myself up to be the weapons squad leader. So at 24 years old, I was the third highest ranking non-commissioned officer out of about 40 guys. And my men respected me. There was the brotherhood and the calling. My wife understood it. And we just had a newborn. So it really made sense to go back overseas. Not to be away from my family, but, you know, the overseas pay is better than the stateside pay. And I just didn't think that my guys should go without me. So I had my sergeant major cancel my orders. I mean, I asked him nicely, obviously, and had him cancel my orders. I went overseas, and first day on the ground, we were right in it. I mean, it started up. We kind of, I guess, shook a hornet's nest. The other unit that we replaced, you know, they told us, you know, don't go here, don't go there, da-da-da-da-da. And, of course, we had to go poke the bear. So we went here, we went there, we went everywhere. And first day was a massive firefight. And we were trying to cross this dry riverbed, and all these rounds started skipping off at the guys in the dry riverbed. And I'm the weapons squad leader, so I have the 240 Bravos and my team set up, and all hell breaks out. So we start ripping rounds, and everybody takes a knee or takes a prone position. And that's the first time my guys saw me in action. My first sergeant knew who I was from my deployments, knew how I acted, but if I wasn't in a firefight, I was always happy, smiling, joking around, not your typical, you know, guy you see in the movies, like grumpy and gruff and whatever. And our first firefight we got into, a guy went down. We thought he got shot. He tore his knee up pretty bad, meniscus and ACL and MCL and stuff. And my first sergeant was like, third squad, go get him. And I said, no, I got this. So I threw my M4 and I ran down about football field and a half a length down to the wadi. I put him on my back and I ran him out, set him down behind a building. And I got my M4 back, and I was the last one on the objective with the forward observer. We popped smoke for the Kiowas to come in, and then we, you know, went back to our forward operating base. And that was a day that everybody found out there's a different side to me than what they see, you know. And I had two guys that were team leaders in a 508, which is infantry battalion, that were new to our unit, that were like, hey, Sergeant Mills, we didn't know how you got your staff sergeant rank. We didn't know why you're weapons squad leader, which is, you know, the senior slot, because, you know, I was younger than the other E6s. I had less time in grade. And they said, well, after today, like, we'll follow you to hell and back. And I was like, well, I appreciate that, guys. And then every time we got in firefights, from there on out, I would go to the front and start singing like 80-second songs, because I knew it annoyed them, but they didn't rank me, you know. So, and then it became this fun thing we always did whenever we got in a really big firefight. We'd high five each other and things like that. And we were, you know, 5 out of 7 days a week probably in it. And then on my a month and a half into my deployment, we had a phone call from a village elder come in that he needed some help in the village. Pretty typical. And on April 10th of 2012, we went on a patrol. And we always had a minesweeper guy out front sweeping the ground, checking it. And we did that not once but twice to make sure everything was secure and safe and marked it clear. And it was, for all intents and purposes, for what we were looking for. And I took my backpack off, and a 120-pound backpack hit the ground, and underneath it was an IED. So the bomb went off, and it tore off my right arm and right leg instantly. They never found those pieces of me. Unfortunately, they just, you know, vaporized. And I got thrown on the left side of my face, and when I rolled over my back and I saw the aftermath of what happened, my right side's gone. My left leg was snapped to the bone. I had muscle and tendon holding it kind of on. But if you imagine your left ankle bone touching your left thigh, mine was doing that. And then my left wrist was blown out really bad. And at that point, my medic, Dan Bateson, was on me, and I told him, don't worry about it, save my guys in my line of work. I didn't think I was going to make it home, not because I was suicidal, but just the guys that I had to say goodbye to, I thought had less injuries than I had. So I said, don't waste your time and go save my guys. It'll be over quick, and, you know, it is what it is. He ignored that, and him and my platoon sergeant, Sergeant Hambright, who's now a sergeant major, put tourniquets on all four of my limbs. You know, so within 30 to 40 seconds, they had tourniquets on all my limbs. While they were working on me, two things were happening. One, I was telling myself not to freak out. I kept seeing the movie Saving Private Ryan in my head, as weird as that sounds to everybody, because in the movie, the medic gets shot in the stomach. He cries out for his mom. He begs not to die, and he ultimately dies. And I was told myself, no matter what happens, like, I'll never be that guy. You know, I was always first in a firefight, last out. I never showed fear. I exuded confidence. And at that point, I wasn't going to show anything like that to my guys, because my last, breaths on the earth that I thought I was going to take was not going to be, you know, having them have a memory of me crying out and begging to live. So some in my unit would say maybe I was a little bit, not crazy, like not like weird, but just always smiling no matter how bad the situation was. I just kept pushing, and I had a sniper round hit 6 inches from my head, and I rolled in on one of these days. I rolled into the fighting pit I was fighting out of, and I was so mad at myself. I stood up on a berm and just ripped like a magazine and a half off of that, where it came from. Like, I mean, I stood right up, because I was mad that, I don't know why, kind of dumb, right? And then they were like on a raid camera watching. Like, we have like these cameras that will reach out and see everything. So from our base, they were watching us. And my buddy Rick Lydon was watching the camera that day, and he goes, that's either the CO or that's Sergeant Mills. And my first sergeant goes, yeah, that's Mills, definitely. And I don't know why it was like that, but when I was injured, I didn't want to have that be their memory. So I told myself, like, just stay calm. Matter of fact, I reached out to my microphone, my left hand, because it still worked. It was blown out the wrist really bad, but I still had my thumb, index, and middle finger. And I reached up, and I hit the microphone and called my lieutenant and said, hey, 6, this is 4. I got guys injured. You know, I need your medic with mine. And he sent Doc Voice over. So Doc Voice worked on the other two guys that were injured. And then he came and worked on me. They put a sternum IV in me. It's the only pain I actually felt that day. And then they put me on a helicopter. And on the helicopter, there was me and two guys, Ryan and Brandon. And one guy was yelling out. He had a lot of pain. And he well-deserved, right? I'm sure he was in a lot of pain. I know he was. And I yelled at the flight medic, hey. I said, hey. I said, take your helmet off. And he couldn't hear me because he had his big spacesuit helmet on. And I said, hey, and I might say some choice words, you know. I said, take your helmet off. Again, might have been more colorful than that. And I got my arm out of the strap that they tied it down to and broken dangling. I said, I went like this and I made the motion. And he took the helmet off and I said, hey, give my guys water and tell them they're gonna be okay. And they put this protective goop in my eye from the rotor wash that won't scratch up your eyeballs and stuff. And it looked like I was looking through beer goggles. But I picked my head up enough where I could see them. I gave them a wink and I said, you guys are gonna be fine. We're gonna be okay. And the flight medics actually, they took care of them, right? They were taking care of them. I knew they were taking care of them, but the guy calling out in pain, I wanted them to calm him down. And you know, I gave him the wink, you know, whatever, and reassured him. And then the flight medics actually sent my wife a really nice letter about that they couldn't believe, you know, that in my situation that I was doing that. And I look at it as I had nothing else to do. So, you know, but we actually published that letter in my book, Tough As They Come. I wrote a book, it's a New York Times bestseller, and I'm very proud of the way it came out. But I got to, you know, put that letter in there, you know, and things like that. But made it to the hospital. They rolled me into surgery, and I'm still awake at this time, and I keep trying to sit up. But the third time I tried to sit up, and the third time that nurse pushed me down, I looked at her and said, hey, quit touching me, I'm fine, like, leave me alone. I got to get back to my guys. And she's like, Sergeant Mills, I don't know how you're still awake right now, but you need to go to sleep. And then I looked at her, I was like, my little girl, am I ever going to see her again? Because my daughter was 6 months old, right? So my daughter, Chloe, was only 6 months old, and I didn't know if I was waking up again. At that point, I was not going to be in charge of, you know, my consciousness. So she knocked me out. I asked about my daughter, and I went out. And then what I was told is 9 doctors and 7 nurses worked on me for 14 hours. 2 nurses, basically for 9 hours, pumped air in and out of my lungs to keep me alive, like you see on TV. And then they ran out of blood that day in the blood bank with A-positive universal blood. So they had people doing buddy blood. If you had A-positive blood, you go to the front of the hospital and you donate your blood. If you have universal, nurses were giving me blood. And, you know, I got to meet these doctors and nurses later on, a couple of them, and tell them thanks for believing my life mattered. You know, they loosened up one tourniquet. I bleed out in 2 minutes or less, but instead 14 hours of operations thinking that, you know, that I mattered. So, you know, we get through the surgery. I come out stable but critical. They keep me medically sedated. I'm a triple amputee. Right, my right arm, both legs are gone, and then they go ahead and take me to from Kandahar on the 10th. They take me on the 12th to Bagram, take me in for a washout, and they realized my left hand had necrotized, the skin died, so they had to cut my left hand off, and I became a quadruple amputee. And then 2 days after that, they flew me to Landshut, Germany, and they woke me up from my medical sedation on April 14th, which is my 25th birthday, actually in real life. And I wake up, and the only person in the room was my brother-in-law, because before anybody deploys now, they fill out paperwork. And the paperwork is in the Army called a blue book. And it's the most morbid thing you'll do. And it's, you plan your funeral. And, you know, it's like, where you're going to be buried, what kind of service, what music, what's in your coffin with you. But the last question is, who escorts your body home, if anybody? So mine was always going to be Josh. And Josh had me put down if anything happened to him. And he was the only one in the room when I came to. When I woke up, you know, I asked him, the first thing was, my soldiers, how are my soldiers? And he told me, you know, Ryan's here, Brandon's there, they're going to be okay. You took most of the blast. I said, okay. And then I asked him, am I paralyzed? And he said, no. And I said, Josh, I can't put my fingers and toes. That you can tell me the truth, am I paralyzed? And he said, you're not paralyzed, but you don't have them anymore. And the only thing I said was, oh. And then for 3 hours, I literally ignored everybody, doctors, nurses. Him. They had questions, but I had my own questions, right? We all would in that situation. Like, I was asking, am I a bad person? Does God hate me? What did I do wrong in life to deserve this? How can I still be a husband and a father? And you not, like I said, non-suicidal, but just, I was like, why didn't I just die? Like, how is this going to be better? And for 3 hours, those swirled in my head, you know? And then finally, Josh chimed in. I had to call my wife and my parents, and I said, yeah, I guess you're right. So I called my wife first, and when she answered, I said, hey, what's up? I'm fine. Like, love you, bye. I didn't want to have a conversation about it. And then I called my parents, and I about the same conversation. My mom did yell happy birthday through the phone, and then my mom and dad hung up. And, you know, 3 days after that, I made it back home to Walter Reed in Bethesda and saw my wife for the very first time. And the reunion isn't exactly what people thought it was going to be. Like, I came rolling in, and on the flight over with the CAT C team, which are fantastic people. If you guys want a good story, have one of those people on. They're great. They said, Mrs. Mills, your husband's right leg is ripped open, his suture split. We have to cut 2 inches off his right leg, but we need you to sign the paperwork. Now you are in charge of medical care, and if you don't, he'll bleed out. So here's my 23-year-old wife with a six-month-old on her hip getting told, sign this so we can, you know, take more of your husband's leg off, and all she wants to do is talk to me. And I'm talking to her like, hey, it's fine, just sign the paperwork. You're good, just sign the paperwork. We're okay. And then the 18th, you know, after my surgery, the next day she came in the 18th, and I talked to her, and I was like, hey, I appreciate you being here, but you should take the house and the cars and the money. I've thought about it. Like, anything saved up we have is yours, but you should go. Like, take everything and go. You know, this is not the life I would choose for you. And here I am. I feel like I'm going to be a burden. I got to be fed now. I got to be dressed, you know, and help with everything. Imagine being a 25-year-old baby, basically. You know, I told her, I don't want this for you. Like, it's okay. And she, a little bit offended, and she's like, we'll get through this together, you know. So, you know, my success story that I have directly relates to my support system with my wife and my daughter, you know, and my family.
So just to back up for a second, so you were perfectly aware of all of the major surgeries and amputations that were happening. It's not like you woke up weeks later and found out that this had happened to you. You were consciously aware that this was going on.
I was definitely conscious until they medically sedated me. So I knew my right side was completely gone and nothing left of it. I knew that my left leg was really bad shape, you know, if it was touching my left thigh. So that was, they actually duct taped it like that for the flight. My hand I still had use of, but I did look up and see it and things like that, you know. It was not fun at all.
So you talked about the 3 hours of why am I still alive? Why is this happening? In the movie that you also made about your story, it seems like once you knew what the goals were, you kind of shifted to all in, we're doing this, I'm not following this timetable, we're gonna get this done a lot sooner. So talk about that mental transition from why am I in this situation to forget this timetable, I'm gonna do it as soon as possible, I'm gonna win this.
So I think the key to my success is pretty simple, and it was just summed up to me recently, and I never thought of it the way that this gentleman told me about just life in general. You know, we were talking about homeless vets and things like that, having a conversation, and he said, you know, Travis, my, you know, belief is with the military, why the military works out so great and people have no problems in the military is because everything's easier when you have to. And I even wrote that down for my new book I'm writing right now, because he's right. When I'm sitting in a hospital bed, 110 pounds lighter, right, with no arms, no legs, wondering why didn't I just die, realizing I didn't die, and that I'm not gonna die, I had nothing to do but get better. And then my daughter, right? My daughter is everything. The reason for my success is easily summed up to her. You know, I'm still her dad at the end of the day. I'm still, you know, gonna be there for her. She'll see me struggle for sure, but there's nothing I won't do for her. And I have a son now too, he's 4, right? I mean, he's after the injury, but he's 4 now. So when I'm in the hospital bed telling my wife she should leave me, she says no, and I'm sitting there wondering what life's gonna be like, and then I see people in the same situation that come see me in my room with no arms, no legs. You know, Todd nicely came to visit me. He's the second ever quadruple amputee. I'm the 4th to survive my injuries from the wars of Afghanistan and Iraq. You just sit there and you realize, like, I have no other option. You know, I don't mean to sum it up so simply why I was able to recover, but that's as easy as it is to me. You know, I had nothing to do but sit there and either accept people feeding me or get an arm. You know, accept rolling around in a wheelchair, being pushed around, you know, or getting legs back on. You know, having my daughter have to watch me ask for help or just doing it myself. You know, I drive my daughter gymnastics at practice Mondays and Wednesdays. I take her to soccer and basketball. I take my son to school. You know, I do those things. I'm there with them. And yeah, I'm a little different. Don't get me wrong. Like, I understand that I stand out. But in my community, I've made myself very well known. I'm jumping ahead here, but I'm an entrepreneur. I own numerous businesses, fortunately, just a lot of debt. But I own some businesses. I have my nonprofit that's very successful, I would say. Very thankful for that because the people that believe in us. And I don't let people see me as anything different. When you first meet me, yeah, I have no arms and legs, I get it. But after we hang out, you see, I'm pretty capable for the most part. And my buddy, he asked me to throw the first pitch out at the team I sponsored for Little League this year. And my wife was on the text chain. She goes, Dane, how's he going to throw a ball? Like, he can't throw. He goes, I just forget that he doesn't have, you know. And that's what I go for. Instead of being the guy with no arms, no legs, I like being like, oh, the guy that owns, you know, the White Duck Brew Pub restaurant, or the guy that has that Travis Mills Foundation, and things like that. And that's what I go for. So change the narrative. But I guess to get back to my recovery process, I didn't have a choice.
Best compliment you can get, right? When somebody forgets.
Yeah, absolutely. I get worried. People are like, hey, you're the same guy you were before. And it depends when they knew me in life. Because like high school teachers say that. I'm like, I'm so sorry.
How many surgeries did you end up having, and how long was it before you could really get to the physical therapy part?
As unbelievable as this might sound, I actually only had 10 surgeries that were like the major ones with washouts. I was with an arm within 5 weeks of my injury, so a month and a week I had my arm. And just shy of 2 months, I was up and walking again on short legs. So my recovery process was faster because I had no internal injuries. My wounds healed up really well, and what you see is what you got. And you know, it was just luck of the draw with that kind of stuff. So I was walking again just shy of 2 months.
You mentioned basically having to relearn everything, whether it's walking, dressing, eating, writing. What were the biggest challenges for you?
Well, everything's a problem you have to solve. Everything's something you have to check out and see, like, you know, how am I going to bend my wrist on this, or how am I going to, you know, make my hand position to put this on and things like that. So I think people always wonder, like, how long it took me to learn how to use the hand, because it, you know, opens, rotates, right? Doesn't even hurt. But people wonder, like, how long did it take you? The truth is, I had nothing. So it didn't take me long to understand it and figure it out. It took me like 6 months to be proficient. But I think when everything's stripped away, you know, you just want it so bad that it's not hard anymore. It's just, how do I figure it out?
Much more with Afghanistan war veteran Travis Mills when we come back on Veterans Chronicles. We're speaking with Travis Mills. He's a veteran of the U.S. Army, 82nd Airborne Division. Served 3 deployments in Afghanistan in 2012. He was severely injured, lost all 4 limbs. You mentioned your wife and her initial reaction to your suggesting that this wasn't the life that she was going to want for herself. Then when you're in the day-to-day grind of it and then making progress, talk about the effect on your relationship and the role she played in your recovery.
Yeah, I mean, my wife was huge in my recovery. Kelsey stuck by my side with our 6-month-old daughter. But there was also my parents there. And then when I got better, and my in-laws were there, and when I got better enough to have an apartment at Walter Reed, you know, about 5 months into my recovery where they didn't have to rotate no more, my father-in-law moved in with us. He retired early from his job and for 14 months lived with us at Walter Reed. And there are really some unsung, you know, like there are heroes in my story. I don't know if I'd still be married and things like that without having the support that we had. So for me, you know, it's not lost on me that people stepped up to help out either Kelsey or me or both of us, you know, whether it was her parents or my parents or things like that. But Kelsey is, she's absolutely fantastic, you know. And I think the reason I'm so driven after she said she's going to stay with me is because I want her to see me as her partner in life, not her patient, right? Not my caretaker. Yeah, I need help. Like, I got 5 minutes of my day I hate, right? I got my legs on, which I need help doing. I got to help put my pants on the button. I can't really do that well, you know, and put my arm on the right way. But once I get them on, I'm pretty independent, you know, pretty good. And I just got to make sure that it's the relationship of husband and wife, not patient caretaker, even though I do need help with things. And that's always been my focus, you know. This happened to both of us for sure. And as bad as I, you know, can feel about this is the life she has to live and my kids have to live, they take it in stride. You know, I give them every opportunity and every chance I can to have a better life, and I work all the time and just do anything I can to make their life better.
Just a year after your injuries, you founded the Travis Mills Foundation. What was your thinking behind that, and what's the purpose of the organization?
The Travis Mills Foundation was an idea my wife and I had to give back. We were given so much love and support at Walter Reed that we thought we should do something. And we founded it because I remember the care packages I got overseas from my wife and my parents and my in-laws and my friends, because I told them, hey, look, I want pepper jerky, right? I want Orbit gum because it holds the flavor the longest. Stride does not do that. I don't care who Stride is watching. But anyways, I wanted a 5-pound bag of gummy bears because I love gummy bears. And, you know, just things that you want. Like Hillshire Farms has their Christmas kits where you get like the salami and the cheese and the crackers and the spicy mustard. And, I wanted that. And I thought, some of the care packages you got were like socks and baby powder. It's like, that's all good, but, you know, get the good stuff. So what I did was talk with Kelsey, and we decided to do care packages at first. So we donated $5,000 from ourselves, and we sent care packages to my guys and their new units they were with, right? So we sent out hundreds of care packages, well, with all the good stuff, you know what I mean? And then I was still at the hospital, and we started doing all these cool trips, and I got, you know, better and better, and I would learn how to go whitewater rafting and kayaking, downhill mountain biking, snowboarding, mono skiing, and all this cool stuff. But because of my injuries, I was injured to the point where I needed what's considered a non-medical assistant. So Kelsey got to go on these trips with me, and the funding was for the service member. And then if a service member was injured, like I am, or that needed assistance, putting on prosthetics, making sure, you know, help with all that stuff, then they got to bring a non-medical assistant with them. So my wife got to come enjoy these trips with me and like see the adrenaline rush and me realizing, hey, look, I won't teach my son how to throw a spiral and like catch out in the yard. I know that. I've accepted it. But I will be able to still go and do kayaking and fun outdoor activities with them. And it was such an adrenaline rush to go down Mount Crested Butte on a mountain bike, right, 9,000 foot mountain, and just have that freedom that I was like, this is amazing. And then we got thinking, well, we're moving to Maine, where she's originally from. And we should, you know, bring some families out. You know, started really modestly. Just, you know, rented a camp from a guy, wasn't really adapted that well, brought some families out. And it went really well the first year, so we did it again the next year for a week, and then we thought we got some traction. So we bought a facility. It was in really bad disrepair. Elizabeth Arden, she was a cosmetic pioneer. She built a house in 1929 up in Maine. And she was like the first ever to do like one of the wealthiest women in the world, you know, in 1929. Or wealthiest people, actually. And she had this building that she constructed where she lived in Maine, and she had like retreats for women like Mimi Eisenhower and Judy Garland and all these famous people. And when I bought her old estate, it was in really bad shape. We did about two and a half years of renovations, which are like $2.5-3 million renovations. And we had no funding really, except for when I go and speak at companies, and then they would, you know, pay me to be a speaker, but then also give back and believe in my mission. And we did it from the grassroots, right? And we opened officially in 2017, the Travis Mills Foundation Veterans Retreat Center. We bring out combat and service-connected disabled veterans with physical injuries and their families. So 8 families per week with paralyzation, amputation, spinal cord injuries, something physical that happened to them. And we show them how to do things adaptively, right? There's fishing and hiking and kayaking and archery, ice fishing, and dog sled rides. And we do it because the family's all going through it, not just a service member, but we let them know these other, you know, 7 families, so there's 8 families that come total every week and say, hey, look, you're not alone. Do not live life on the sidelines. Always be active in society and active in your family. And understand you can still do things adaptively. And, you know, we started out with 1 staff member, then 2. Now we're up to like 20-some. And I don't take a dime. We've raised quite a bit of money, and we're one of the top VSOs for what we do. And we also partner with Warrior Path Program, which is out of Boulder Crest Foundation in Virginia. And it's a post-traumatic stress program for first responders and combat veterans. And, you know, it's one of the best in the nation. It's non-clinical, train-the-trainer style. And anybody that's suffering should come our way because it's free for them. So, you know, to date we've helped over 800 families that were able to come, over like 100 or 200 post-traumatic stress veterans that came. We started this program about 2 years ago, and we're just so lucky and grateful to be able to work that we do. And as the founder president, I don't take a dime. I never will pay myself, and we're going to keep growing and doing great things because people out there believe in us.
What's the difference you see in these families once they've gone through that week and connected with other families probably long after that?
They do. There's lifelong friends to be made, and they come in and some of them are a little bit hesitant and they don't want to try something, but then they get shown a picture of me doing something, or I'll go out there and talk to them and see how their life's going and figure out if they need any help with anything. I spend about 2 hours out there for the week though. because I have just a lot of other obligations. But just letting them know that we're here for them and that life's not over and that they can do things is amazing. And then we just started a new program called Recalibrate, because instead of being called a wounded warrior, I don't like being called wounded. I think it has negative connotations. That's not a knock on anything. Wounded would imply I'm still hurt. So I say I'm recalibrated, if anything, because I have a new normal. So we have a recalibrate program where, say, a family comes in, they really enjoyed kayaking, but maybe they can't afford kayaks. Well, we find a way to get them kayaks. Maybe they enjoyed horseback riding. Maybe the couple wants to do a culinary school or class together. We want to help them. And we base it off of, if we help you, you got to give so many hours of community service back. You know, it's a hand up, not a handout, and we're here for you. And our biggest concern that we have is that they come for the week. Maybe that's the best week they have all year, but what are they doing the rest of the 51 weeks out of the year? We want to make sure we keep in touch, keep them motivated, keep them going, and help them out. And, you know, we've been very successful, and I just have an amazing staff, and we run things a little bit different because me and my father-in-law, who's the Vice President Craig, and my CFO, my COO, and my CFMO, right, Chief Facilities Maintenance Officer, either way, we have five people that it's basically a democracy. We all run together. We vote on things. Yes, I have executive powers, but I don't ever flash those unless I absolutely have to. And we all make decisions together for the betterment of the foundation. So there's no dictator ruling. I mean, I guess I am, but you know what I mean.
You're a benevolent dictator.
I mean, I don't like to say yes or no to things that we're arguing about, but if I have to step up, I do.
Now, obviously, you have an impressive platform to speak to people who have been through traumatic injury, whether it's loss of limb, PTSD, traumatic brain injury, whatever the injury might be. For those of us who haven't been through that and don't have that platform, but we see veterans struggling with whatever they might be struggling with, what's the best way for the rest of us to connect with them and help them?
So I think the best way for people to connect with veterans is treat them normal. Everybody asks me, like, hey, if I see someone like you, like, what do I say? And I'm like, hi or hello. I think people that are struggling really need help with just being reintegrated in society, not treated different because they are a veteran, because maybe they are struggling. You know, it's more about a conversation of, hey, how's everything going? What's new today? And less of the sympathy side of it. You know, I think the word veteran gets tossed around so much in a negative context that there's really been a stigma about, oh, you're a veteran, like, what's wrong? Things like that. But for me, I try to encourage people to check out my website, you know, TravisMillsFoundation.org. And get involved, whether they want to volunteer or just see what we're doing. Because my CFO is married to a former Marine. My COO is married to a First Sergeant. She's also the daughter of a Colonel from the Army. And my Chief Facilities Maintenance Officer was a retired First Sergeant. We have a lot of people that work for us that have a connection with the military. And I think understanding is important, but also just sending them in the right direction. You know, so if they're having a rough time, that's what we're here for. We're here to help. The Travis Mills Foundation's here to help. And if we can't help, we'll connect you with who can help. Whether that's Gary Sinise Foundation or Independence Fund or Yellow Ribbon Fund or any one of the hundreds that are out there that we're fortunate to know and work with.
Are you still glad you joined the Army and served our country in Afghanistan?
Yes, I am still glad. So let me rephrase that. It's funny, I get asked all the time, you know, if I could do it all over again, would I still do the same route and do the same thing? And I say 100% no. I would not get blown up ever again. No matter how much good in the world I'm doing, how many lives have changed, how many people write in and tell me that what my story meant to them, I would not get blown up. But luckily for me, I've learned early on in my injuries I can't change the past. So I don't dwell on it. I just reminisce what I had. It's one of my life lessons I live by. And I think it's important everybody knows, like, as much as I would change getting blown up, I would not change the military. I loved it. I think it's a great opportunity for people to, you know, find themselves. You know, I was an all-star athlete in high school. I went to college, played football. I had the choice to play baseball at the college, but I wasn't into school. I was just wasting time and money. And I got to grow up really, you know, I grew up in Michigan, but when I got to be 18 and basic training and everything, I really grew up in Fort Bragg, and I have very fond memories of the military. I don't look at my injuries as the Army's fault. I don't look at it as something that I wish I'd go back and, or that I'm so mad about getting injured that I hate the Army, because the truth is, the Army's got great opportunities. Every branch has great opportunities. I wanted to be infantry. I mean, I had signed up to be like a lineman in the Air Force, right? Get my journeyman's card, be a lineman. I was going to go do that. Heavy equipment operator, in the Army Reserves while I went to college, there was a lot of options I had. They showed me airborne infantry, and I said, that's the, yep, now I want it. And I re-enlisted for it. You know, I had the opportunity. There was, I was going to go prime power. It's like substation operators and generator mechanics and people that keep, like, cities going. I mean, you get out with six-figure jobs after your enlistment's up. And I had it all set up, and my first sergeant said, is that what you really want? I said, no, I love my job. So I think, you know, I went like really long and winded on this one, but I wouldn't take back joining the military. I would not get blown up if I could, but that's not my life, you know, and no matter how many times I would sit there and close my eyes and hope and pray and wish this never happened, I still would wake up in the hospital bed, and guess what? It's still what happened. So I don't dwell on it. I reminisce what I had, make the best of my future, and you know, this past April was 10 years for me, and I've had some really awesome, you know, times and incredible years. And, you know, that's one of the things I pride myself on, is not getting lost in, like, the, well, what if I didn't do this, or what if I could change that, because it will drive you nuts. And then the next thing I tell people is you can't always control a situation, but you can always control your attitude. And my situation literally never changes. I wake up with no arms, no legs every morning now. And if I'm at my house in Maine, I jump from my bed to my wheelchair, I get my arm off the charger, I get my coffee, I get my wife's coffee set up, you know, she comes out, the kids come down, and we just go about our day. And my attitude is always positive because I was given the chance. And I know this isn't airing today, but it is Memorial Day. And people wonder how I stay so positive. Well, I have friends I had to say goodbye to that left behind parents and spouses and children. And I truly think it'd be selfish if I was ever angry and quit, because I gave my arms and legs, which didn't want to, it sucked, it happened, but I did not give everything, and I'm here watching my children grow. I'm here a part of life every day, and you know, for their sacrifice and so many others that I don't know, I'm gonna make the best of it.
You've probably already touched on this in a number of different places, but finally, what are you most proud of from your service?
I think for my service, I'm most proud of the lives I was able to impact, the leadership that I was able to, you know, I guess, learn and create to the point where people, when I need them the most, came to my aid. You know, when they carry a stretcher, it's usually like four guys. I had like 10 guys. Just, I think that's, you know, that's what I miss the most, the brotherhood. But I don't know. I guess I just loved every minute of it, so it's kind of weird, right? Kind of weird. But, I don't know what the question was anymore. What was the question? Because I'm really trying hard to look away from you.
What are you most proud of?
From the military, right?
Yes.
Okay, I was going to say, most proud of my children. you know, but from the military, just, you know, knowing that people could count on me, I was there for them. And, I wasn't overweight. I was just a really big guy. I was like 22-inch biceps, 6'3", and when I needed to be carried out, not one person shied away. They just right there for me. And not that people shy away, but you know what I mean. So, yeah, I think I'm proud of that. I'm proud of my service. I'm proud to serve my country and thankful for the opportunity. You know, as weird as it sounds, you know, with arms and legs now. But yeah.
Travis, it's an incredible story. Thank you for sharing it. Thank you for your time today. And thank you for your service.
Hey, no, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. sorry about the emotions there. I didn't mean to. Thanks for having me.
Travis Mills is a veteran of the U.S. Army, 82nd Airborne Division, served three tours of duty in Afghanistan, was struck by an improvised explosive device in 2012, and is a quadruple amputee. He's also the founder of the Travis Mills Foundation. I'm Greg Corumbus. This is Veterans Chronicles.
And check out TravisMillsFoundation.org.
Hi, this is Greg Corumbus, and thanks for listening to Veterans Chronicles, a presentation of the American Veterans Center. For more information, please visit AmericanVeteransCenter.org. You can also follow the American Veterans Center on Facebook, and on Twitter, we're at AVC Update. Subscribe to the American Veterans Center YouTube channel for full oral histories and special features. And of course, please subscribe to the Veterans Chronicles podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and please join us next time for Veterans Chronicles.